You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. We have a special show today in that we have three writers who are going to be talking with me about, would you call it an issue, a stylistic question, an aesthetic question? I guess we'll be settling that in the course of this. They are women who are involved in Sisters in Crime, which is a national organization of women who write mystery stories, and they are Nancy Picard, who is the president of the organization, Susan Dunlap, who is the publicity director for Sisters in Crime, and Marilyn Wallace, who has edited an anthology from Berkeley Books called Sisters in Crime, which includes 22 stories by women mystery writers, not all of whom are members of the organization, but all of whom are sympathetic with the organization's aims. Nancy's most recently published book in paperback is Dead Crazy, one of the mysteries in the Jenny Kane series. Susan Dunlap's most recent book is Pious Deception, which has just been published by Villard Books. And Marilyn Wallace's most recent paperback is A Case of Loyalties, published by Ballantyne.
Primary Target, actually.
Published by Bantam. Is that the most recent one?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I thought I'd begin by asking you all what kind of mystery writing you do. As I was reading these books, there were introductions talking about hard-boiled writers and locked chamber writers, and there are all sorts of heroes and heroines and victims and informers, police procedurals. What do you each specialize in, Susan Dunlap?
Actually, there are three major types of detectives in mysteries. There are the police detectives, the private eyes, and the amateurs, and I write them all. Pious Deception is a private eye. And I kind of like doing a private eye because you get a little bit of both. You get somebody who has a professional commitment to the case that they're doing, and professional standards and professional training. You also get a lot of freedom, freedom to make decisions, freedom to break the law, freedom for the writer.
The narrator there has been involved with autopsies. And a kind of female Quincy is what I read in the publicity literature. Is that what's called hard-boiled, because you have, you know, the facts, what they used to call just the facts, ma'am? And what does that mean?
I don't think it's hard-boiled. Hard-boiled seems to me more of an emotional statement, more of the loner detective. The lack of friends, the just this type of thing. Whereas Kiernan was a forensic pathologist with the coroner's office, but she uses her medical ability to solve the case, but she herself is very emotionally involved in solving this case and in dealing with the psychological problems of the priest who was killed, and seeing where she herself comes in regard to him and how she changes during the case.
Nancy Picard?
If there are mysteries that are hard-boiled and mysteries that are soft-boiled, I tend to think of mine as over-easy. My sleuth, Jenny Kane, is an amateur sleuth. She's a contemporary woman, and an 80s woman. I hate to use... She'd better turn into a 90s woman soon, I think. I chose it to do an amateur sleuth because I like putting an ordinary person in an extraordinary situation. And I like having a sleuth with whom I can identify and with whom I hope readers, regular sorts, can identify as well.
And Marilyn Wallace.
My series characters are Jay Goldstein and Carlos Cruz, and they're homicide detectives in the Oakland Police Department. But I'm not sure that I would say that what I do is write police procedurals, because in each of my novels, there's a third strong point of view character, and that person is usually three out of three books, a woman whose life in some way has been affected by the crime, which has been murder in each of these books. And for me, the interesting exploration is in part how these people are affected, how they deal with the aftermath of the crime that has come into their lives, for the most part, not of their own doing.
Now, how would you say, in terms of being sisters in crime, what is the difference between the kind of detective writing that's been being done by women and the writing being done by your group, the writing you would like to see done, the writing you would like to foster?
I don't think that there's a group identity in terms of the kind of writing that Sisters in Crime does. And I think that's one of the things that the anthology is a virtue, is that... Let me stop for a minute.
Yeah, okay.
What was the question again?
What is there a difference between previous writing, mystery writing by women, and the goals of Sisters in Crime?
Okay. I don't think Sisters in Crime as a group has a writing identity. And I think the anthology Sisters in Crime is a good sampling of the spectrum that women both in and out of the organization who are writing crime fiction covers today. It runs a real gamut, and I don't think there is an identity.
Sisters in Crime was really not formed to foster a particular kind of writing. It is, in fact, not made up only of writers. There are probably more fans than writers in the organization. It is basically about 500 or 600 women of mystery, or mysterious women, as I like to think of us. And we tend to be women who either write or read mysteries. As far as I'm concerned, the difference between, if I may slightly take a different slant on the question, the difference between many of the mysteries being written now by women and mysteries that used to be written by women, the main difference is that we have more female protagonists. It used to be, there have been other decades in which just as many women and perhaps even more wrote mysteries, although perhaps they didn't gain very much recognition in doing so, or most of them didn't. But almost all of those women used male protagonists. Not all of them, but almost all of them. And now in the past, 6, 7, 8 years, we've seen an outpouring of female protagonists in mystery fiction. And that is one of the major differences. The second major difference that we're trying to call attention to is the fact that these books exist. We've had a situation in which we have felt that, in essence, a revolution has occurred in the writing of mystery fiction. And for some perfectly understandable reasons, and perhaps for some less understandable ones, the reader has not necessarily been apprised of that fact. And so Sisters in Crime exist to let that huge market of mystery readers who might like to know of the existence of these writers know about us.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, though, because many of the fights that went on in raising the consciousness of America about women's rights were fights about icons and image. This image promotes sexism. Now, in many cases, it's been said that the role of women in mysteries has either been as a body or as a corpse. Is there an attempt to change that? Or how does the, you know, as a woman's group, there must be some sensibility about addressing that issue?
It's certainly an issue that we have considered in Sisters in Crime. And it's a very difficult issue to deal with. There's virtually no disagreement that it's appalling to see gratuitous violence against women in books. Balancing that, on the other hand, is the question of censorship. We don't want in any way to be aligned with censorship. And so what we're doing is just trying to see what exactly is going on. Is this a widespread habit? Or is it just that you read a a few books with gratuitous violence, and they stick in your mind. What we would like to do in the organization is to be very careful to have our facts clear and then work from that basis.
I think because we have more female protagonists, we are seeing the replacement of women as corpse, for instance, because now there are more and more women in mysteries who are the protagonist in the mystery, and you can't be a corpse and a protagonist, too, in this sort of novel. Or if they're not the sleuth, they are, as in Marilyn's books, a very central female character who may be a victim of sorts, but who's a very different sort of victim from the victims we've seen in the past.
I think it's really interesting that the people who are writing, the women who are writing mysteries, a lot of us are in our 40s. And we've come out of a whole political consciousness, and we're writing the kinds of characters that reflect that, that reflect a feeling that we can change the world by our presence. And our characters feel the same way. And I think in that way, we're reflecting a whole set of perhaps not consciously stated social and political platforms. Nonetheless, we reflect who we are.
The occasion that brought the Sisters in Crime here to Los Angeles is a gathering at the Small World Books Mystery Annex in Venice. I noticed that when I was reading A Case of Loyalties, Marilyn Wallace, that the book opens on a very human situation, one that I found myself to be interested in. A daughter has stolen a car and is caught. The car happens to be a car with a history, and thereby hangs the novel. But the mother is informed, is taken to the police station. She's a single mother. She's frightened by the situation. And I became very interested, yes, what is that process? Chekhov wrote about it in The Darling, by which a parent decides, my child may be guilty, but I will defend her no matter what she's done. Then I found myself, while interested in the question, rippled a bit to the side. I thought, huh, are teenage girls now stealing cars? Is this, you know, a change in the tide?
Yes, they are. Not my teenage girls. I have teenage boys, neither of whom stole a car. But the events in A Case of Loyalties were suggested to me by two events in the lives of two friends of mine on opposite coasts of this continent, one involving a teenage daughter who indeed stole a car, another who saw a drive-by murder, and I think girls are responding to social pressures in ways that adolescent boys used to today. They're becoming involved in things like stealing cars. I think there is less and less a difference in terms of adolescent behavior according to gender.
Now, Nancy Picard, whose book Dead Crazy is new in paperback, in Dead Crazy, the opening scene brings a society woman to the office of a foundation president, and a lot of fun is had at the society woman's expense. Having worked myself in public relations, I felt very happy, you know, to see the woman, you know, skewered. I do so hope that you'll help these very important people. And yet I thought to myself, do I somehow expect a woman writer of mysteries to reveal another side of this person other than the many chins of Mrs. Chauvenet and her charity ball?
Well, I think that Jenny Skewert, my heroine, skewered herself with that chapter, because in the beginning of the next chapter, at the end of that one, we see that Jenny has caught herself on her own stereotypes, and that was part of what I wanted to accomplish in that chapter. I wanted to show that that what we may see, even in this rich socialite who volunteers, as Jenny says, goes to meetings in order to learn how to run better meetings, that there may very well be real human reasons for what she does, and that below the surface something else is going on. So, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that there was that I purposely presented to a great extent a stereotype, but I did it to snag Jenny.
Susan Dunlap, in Pious Deception, there is the question of the burial of a priest. Can he, if he has in fact committed suicide, be buried on sanctified ground? Now, many people have said that the mystery is a Catholic form, and in fact, G.K. Chesterton wrote parables in the form of mystery stories. To what extent does Catholicism play in this book?
Well, I started off thinking about Catholicism in the very bureaucratic sense. The Catholic Church as the great bureaucracy in the world. And I find that's a theme through my books, is the person trying to deal with the intricacies of a bureaucracy. And in a sense, a church is the ultimate bureaucracy. I mean, another bureaucracy, you screw up, the bureaucracy fires you.
Mm-hmm.
This bureaucracy, you screw up and you suffer through eternity. Mm-hmm. It's a big price to pay for not playing by the rules.
So that's like your story, No Safety, in which the man who has worked for peace and civil liberties movements in Berkeley discovers that the procedures that have brought guns into the society has, despite his own best efforts, brought a gun into his daughter's hand.
Yes, that and what I wanted to think about in that story was what do objects do to your life? In the sense of, here is a man who picks up, by accident, picks up this gun, a thing that he would no way have in his house, but just the possession of this gun changes him and changes the entire future of his family.
I'm curious, and I don't know who to direct this at. You know, different kinds of writers notice different things about people. When I'm sitting and talking to crime writers and women crime writers, I find myself wondering, what do you notice? You must be like people gathering, you know, notes, and with on the one side a feminine eye, on the other side a detective's eye. Are people nervous with you in the world?
They should be.
People frequently say to my husband that he should be looking over his shoulder all the time, and as if he should be nervous. And I always say, well, he's the safest man I know, because if anything happened to him, I'd be the first person they would suspect. If you wonder what mystery writers noticed, when I started my first book, a book called Generous Death, I got the idea from that book from being at the Nelson Atkins Gallery of Art in Kansas City, and they have a wonderful Oriental collection where there is a rosewood testered bed. And I looked at that bed, and where a normal person would think, what a beautiful work of art that is, I looked at it and I thought, what a great place to find a dead body. So those are some of the things that mystery writers notice that other people may not.
I think also, for me, life has been a process in which I've seen things all around me. I haven't understood the reasons for everything, and so I make up stories for myself to explain why a person is behaving peculiarly, or what to me seems to be peculiarly, and to find now that I can turn this explanation into my life's work is wonderful.
One of the nice things is that nothing is ever wasted.
Uh-huh.
I was driving down here yesterday. It's a long drive from Northern California, and I got a speeding ticket. And I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to come up with a decent enough story off the cuff to get out of the speeding ticket. So I was standing there, and the highway patrolman was riding out, and I said to him, you know, I'd like to come up with a good excuse, but I can't think of any. What have other people told you? And he told me what the other excuses were, and I'll use it.
Well, that's great. That's a wonderful occasion. Almost worth its weight in gold, I would think.
Depending on how much its weight
will
is.
Will you reveal just one?
he said, well, people will get out and they'll say, there's somebody in the car is sick. And I'll say to them, well, okay, let me show you where the hospital is. I said, and then if they go to the hospital, I'll follow them to the hospital, and then I give them the ticket.
Really? Oh, God. No mercy. Talk about Catholic. years ago, Edmund Wilson famously asked, Who cares who killed Roger Ackroyd? And more recently, modern fiction, in turning to the mystery form, has tried to make it a brand new form. Oddly enough, the great South American writer Jorge Luis Borges published his Death in the Compass in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. It was one of his first appearances in America. But the critic Jeffrey Hartman said, in answer to who cares who killed Roger Ackroyd, that the whodunit has become a whodonut, a mystery with a hole at the center, and that there need no longer necessarily be a culprit. In fact, there can, in a sense, be victimless crimes, as well as victims without crimes, as well as a sense of a kind of brooding menace that causes bodies to appear without explanation. Any thought about, I know, for instance, you've written a metafictional mystery story in the Sisters in Crime anthology. And any comment about the way modern fiction techniques and, you know, that odd insistence that there be a solution at the end of the book? Any response on that?
Well, mysteries have changed radically in the past 20 years. When I started to write, I remember reading a book that said, you don't need to worry about character in mysteries. Mysteries are entirely plot. Your character never needs to change. This is entirely untrue now. If you don't care about the character, then you indeed do not care who killed this person. Mysteries have become much more novels, novels of suspense, novels where the ultimate threat happens and where it's dealt with. And for the most part, it's very nice to have something tied up and to have a solution, to have something that works in a time when so many things don't work.
Nancy, I thought I'd ask you this. For instance, Patricia Highsmith brings on a situation, brings in an aberrant type, and lets you see the crime, which might be minor, the stealing of a dog, before your eyes. There is no longer a question of who did it. As for motive, why she done it, it's really aberrancy, the cruelty of the known world, and our having differences of heart in the ways I did it because I felt like it that day seems to be enough for her. And a whole novel will be spent in the tracing of the traveling of malevolence through this filtered world. You've written in Sisters in Crime a mystery story in which really the hero is the environment, is the prairie.
Yes, and I leave the ending pretty ambiguous, I've learned. There's an ending and there isn't an ending. I wrote that story with the idea in mind that this was very much a story in which the story would continue in the reader's mind. I wanted, although there is a climax, the story doesn't end as such, at least in my mind. And what I've discovered since is I've really never had quite so much fun with anything I've written because people who've read it have arguments with each other about what happens next in that story.
It's a very interesting story. As I told you before, I found it Willa Cather-esque, that the subject, a woman from the city, domesticating and getting used to the silence of the prairie and a solitary life. Her own imagination is causing a rift between her and her neighbors who don't want to deal with her constant querulousness and, as they say, whining. And so, you know, it seemed to be a piece about mental atmosphere.
Yes, it was very much a piece about mental atmosphere. It's also, it was interesting to write because all of my other mystery fiction has been in a traditional sort of mode, a whodunit at heart. And because of that, I wrote, page two would follow page one and page three would follow page two. But as I wrote that short story, I found I couldn't do that. I had to write by scenes. I could not write it chronologically. It developed differently, and I think it developed. I had to write it, delve a lot more into my own unconscious in writing this and let things just come out, much more so than I do in having to write a more conventional sort of mystery novel.
For some of those reasons, I found it to be one of the most interesting things in the Sisters in Crime anthology. Marilyn, you used to be an English teacher, and and I hate to hit you with the schoolmarm question, but do you regard it as a subgenre?
Well, what when you were asking about the turns that mystery fiction has taken currently, I was thinking that all of literature at its heart, in a poetic sense, has a mystery to be solved. There is a question to be answered, a dilemma of the human condition to be explored. And in some ways, I think mystery fiction these days is doing just that, and the distinctions between mystery and the greater body of fiction, I think, are blurring quite, quite very strongly, and it's very hard to say this is just a mystery anymore, because those explorations, those questions are being looked at in contemporary mystery fiction.
Are there things that you would like to see in the mysteries of the future that have never been done before, and dare you breathe them now?
Well, needless to say that if any of us had the great idea right now for the great change in the mystery of the future, we would be sitting smugly grinning.
Like the cat who swallowed the canary corpse.
Michael, I think I do. I mean, I don't have the great idea, but I do have a wish, just from my own point of view. When I was writing Dead Crazy, I kept trying to follow the conventions of the mystery. I kept trying to put that dead body right at the beginning of the book. And that story didn't want to have a dead body right at the beginning of the book. And I eventually had to put it on page 75 or 76 or 77, wherever it is, because that story just dictated to me how it would be. I would like the mystery genre to become even more free than it is now, so that that sort of thing doesn't even have to cross a writer's mind. Our readers have become very accepting of all sorts of changes and breakings of rules, and I would like to see that expanded. I don't know. There's a tiny avant-garde in the mystery world. There's a lot more of it in the literary world at large, and I'd like to see more of that, if possible.
Alfred Hitchcock used to say that he wanted to always to film the famous scene along a factory production line in which a car is being assembled bit by bit by bit, and then the car door would open and there'd be a body in the back seat. I guess that the best way for a radio show like this to end would be in the middle of a... I've been talking to Susan Dunlap, author of Pious Deception, Marilyn Wallace, the editor of Sisters in Crime, and many mysteries in paperback, four mysteries in paperback, and Nancy Picard, who is the president of Sisters in Crime, and the author of Dead Crazy. We thank you all for being with us on Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. Bob Carlson is our engineer. And we'll see you next week on The Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, books, books.
And say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.